Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
Corey Imperfect Knockrat.
How imperfect of you. But unlike, unlike your imperfections, this episode will be perfect and full of wonderful news.
Wow. Someone has... I
we have the best news. Everyone knows it.
Bestest news.
On today's episode, we'll cover...
People are saying, Mark. What people? Well, just people are saying the 443 has the best news.
We'll cover an upcoming Google Chrome release that'll basically change the way that it browses the websites by default. Pretty dang serious vulnerability in VMware. And then the latest pleas for Microsoft in regards to regulation. And this time, calling for more of it. With that, let's... Go ahead and get started.
We thought we'd see the day Microsoft begs for regulation.
So our first news story is actually a fast forward, I guess, to April with a bit of a preview of what's to come. So in mid-April, somewhere around, I think, the 12th or 13th, Google is going to release Google Chrome version 90. Which includes a few changes, but among them is how it will handle incomplete URLs and what Google calls the Omnibar, which is their name for the browsing bar that you type in web addresses.
I've never called that thing Omnibar. I don't even think of the word Omni when looking at the URL bar.
I'm willing to bet that quite a few Google employees don't even call it the Omnibar. It's the address bar. That's what everyone calls it. But, you know, it's Google, so it's got to have a fancy name. But if you remember, like back in the day, I mean, this is back in the day for me. This is what probably just a blip in the lifetime of Corey. When you used to enter in a web URL, you had to type in the whole http://www.website.com.
www.microsoft.com.
I remember even commercials had to say www in all their URLs back in the day.
Exactly. I mean, there was a time when Amazon was www.amazon.com.
Yep.
But nowadays, though, like there's a lot you can get away with. Like, first off, most websites have gotten rid of the www subdomain. It might still exist, and they just use like a CNAME to redirect it to the root domain. But, you know, people are lazy and they don't like typing four extra characters that they don't have to.
And it's kind of funny, Mark, that you call these incomplete URLs, which technically they are, but we're so used to typing coreysite.com or reddit.com, you know, not even thinking about any of the protocol or beginning of, you know, the sub part of the domain that www or FTP or whatever might be part of.
Now I'm curious, what's hosted on coreysite.com?
I'll have to get something up there. We have to get back into habit of registering domains for things we randomly say on the podcast.
I think I unfortunately let Oops, I Accidentally Went to an AttackSite.com expire.
Oh, bummer.
After 3 years
of
no use.
We should look at the analytics of that. See if anyone looked at it.
But anyways, so at the start of the URL, that HTTP is what specifies the protocol that your browser is going to connect over. So in this case, Hypertext Transfer Protocol. And you specify that because there's actually a bunch of different protocols you can use in a browser. Like you can use FTP to connect to an FTP server. You can use file:// to pull up a file locally on your computer.
It's kind of a local one, yeah.
But if you forget to specify a protocol or choose not to because you're lazy like most of us are in these days, your browser will know to default to HTTP because in general, you're going to use your web browser to pull up websites. But up until now, or I guess up until Chrome 90 in April, it's defaulting to the unencrypted HTTP, which means that if you fail to type in a protocol, it'll first try to load that website at its unencrypted location. Now, that site will most likely redirect you to the encrypted version. Usually the first thing a website does that has both, it'll issue a 302 redirect and send you straight to the HTTPS version of the site. But that isn't always the case, and there's actually some security and privacy concerns with having that first connection over a unencrypted medium. For example, if an attacker is sitting there in a man-in-the-middle scenario, like if you're on public Wi-Fi or they've somehow compromised part of your networking equipment, with that first unencrypted connection, they could basically take over what's going on in there. They could inject a new redirect, they could inject new code, or they could read whatever you're transmitting if that connection doesn't get redirected to HTTPS. And this is a problem for, I guess, most of the internet that Google's trying to solve now, but where in Chrome 90, instead of defaulting to HTTP, it's going to default to HTTPS if you fail to specify the protocol. Now it'll have some things to do in the background to handle scenarios of websites that still don't support HTTPS. For example, if it fails to determine the availability of the site within a certain timeout, it'll fall back to HTTP, but it will at least still provide some security and privacy benefit now for, I guess, the majority of the internet users that don't type in the full, I guess, what, basically everyone outside my grandma and my mom that fail to type in HTTP /www.google.com
to search for Google. I think that wraps up my family too. It's about the same. My parents and grandparents probably still type www.
Yeah.
Now, the good news you mentioned, though, is like, what's the effect of this on both users and sites? Luckily, there should be no effect on this for sites, right? I mean, hopefully sites are up to HTTPS anyways, because that's really where they should be going. But if they're using HTTP, the fact that Google defaults to HTTPS won't be a big deal because of that fallback you mentioned before. So even the sites that unfortunately aren't quite secured yet still will work. Google's just going to be trying HTTPS first if you don't specify.
And the good news is, like, the overwhelming majority of the internet is encrypted these days. Like, the last stat I saw was that 82.2% of websites have a valid SSL certificate. That means that even more probably support encryption but have some sort of issue with their certificate. And then according to Google's own stats, they found that 89% of page loads on Windows computers and 95% on macOS were over HTTPS. So the majority of web traffic is also encrypted these days. So like you said, like, to the end user, you're probably not even going to notice, like, because again, even in its current state, most of these websites immediately redirect to their encrypted version. But it does make it a little more difficult for an attacker that might be in a man in the middle scenario. But it also, it's following a trend of the internet as a whole moving towards a encrypted future, which kind of brings up another topic of, like, there's threats that can still arrive over these encrypted connections. And as we continue to move towards every web connection being encrypted, if you're not doing stuff like HTTPS inspection, you're potentially missing a lot of these threats. Like, even in our own data, we found that 54% of malware came in over a HTTPS encrypted connection. So if you're not inspecting, you're missing potentially half of all malware at your perimeter. And even then, though, like, the volume of even our customer base that does HTTPS inspection is still disappointingly low. And that's pretty much par for the course across the whole industry. Because, like, I get it, it can be a bit of a pain when it comes to set up decryption and inspection at your perimeter. Like, you have to take considerations of deploying certificates, because if you fail to do so, basically every encrypted connection, which is potentially 9/10 of all your users' web traffic, will start throwing certificate warnings, and that won't be a very good user experience. And you also
insecure too, right? Because you'll never know, even when you're going to sites that have proper HTTPS set up, you won't be able to know whether it has. So definitely don't want to set up HTTPS without fixing the certificate issue.
Yeah.
Because you want it to follow the proper process to show you that you trust all the certificates, including the one you'll probably talk about that you have to add in order to set up this HTTPS inspection.
Yeah. I mean, the good news is, like, these days it's actually, I don't want to say easy, but it's a lot easier than it used to be for taking care of the certificate management. Like, if you're in an Active Directory environment, if you're using Active Directory somewhere, like, it's basically taking care of it for you. Active Directory includes a certificate authority that you can use to sign other certificates for your environment, and all those will automatically be trusted by all domain joined computers. If you're not using Active Directory, maybe you're like a smaller shop and you just got a couple computers here and there, like, even then you can still make it easy. You could take the existing proxy authority certificate on the Firebox or whatever the equivalent is and stick it up on a web server somewhere. and then browse to there from your computers, download it, install it. Like the Firebox, for example, has the certificate portal that has this all spun up for you. You could even use something like OpenSSL to create your own certificate authority and sign additional certificates if you want to be extra like that. But basically, you have a whole lot of options to deploy these certificates these days. And I'd hazard to say, like, the majority of offices have some form of domain, at least ones over a certain size, which takes out a lot of the legwork for deploying a certificate. But, like, even outside that, there's other considerations you have to think about, like handling apps that use certificate pinning or non-compliant protocol traffic. Like, for example, Dropbox and Box.com and OneDrive, all those desktop apps tend to use some form of certificate pinning where they're expecting their connection to be encrypted and signed by a very specific certificate. And if it's signed by anything else, it'll fail the connection. And that's for your own security and privacy sake, to prevent people from man-in-the-middling the connection in an app that couldn't show a certificate error. But it does mean you have to consider those and potentially add exceptions as well. But the good news there is, like, at least in Firebox, using that as an example again, and I'm sure other vendors are the same way too, like, we take that in consideration and have cloud apps built in as predefined exceptions in a lot of cases, things that we know flat out won't work with HTTPS inspection, so you can still use the feature without breaking your entire environment.
But it I think it's probably easy to get the cert set up, but I think you're right in giving them advice that you will, you know, after you set this up, expect a day of maybe one or two, I can't get to this site for whatever reason, where you might have to go through and add different exceptions because of the pinning and stuff like that. But it's really well worth it, you know. Despite the fact that it will take a little work to get it set up in a way that still allows people to go everywhere, we highly recommend you do that because of the stat Mark shared. You know, at least half of the malicious stuff we see is happening over HTTPS. You really want to be able to scan that sort of traffic.
And it's one of those things where, like, I know you can say, oh, I've got endpoint protection, why do I need to do all this hubbub to also inspect the traffic at the perimeter? But when 9/10 of internet traffic is encrypted, you're potentially missing insight into 9/10 of traffic. That's like me saying, I don't need to set the deadbolt because, you know, I've got that crappy little lock on the doorknob, and that's going to protect me just the same too. Like, you want layers of security. You want to make sure that you're not just relying on your endpoint protection, but also inspecting it at the perimeter too.
And by the way, we have some really great endpoints, so even protection. So even if it's a really darn good lock on your door, there's always some person that can figure out even the most expensive big lock.
Yeah.
So again, that's why layers are important.
Yeah, there's no
endpoint's a great thing to do too, and you can even have some good stuff out there. But a lot of endpoint nowadays wants the network indicators help it figure things out. So we even have protections like a threat detection response, which might be using some of the network stuff it sees to help the endpoint find bad stuff.
Yeah. And even
so, use both
outside of malware too, like network exploits, like our IPS engine being able to see into encrypted traffic can help you detect a lot of attacks against web applications that you might not have endpoint protection running on, if it's like a web server or something like that, or even just the web browser client. Like, there's a lot of insight you could potentially see by inspecting that traffic too. And I know it's easy for us to sit here and say, oh, just take a day out of your busy lives and go set up HTTPS inspection. But in the end run, like, you're going to be missing a lot of threats if you don't take this opportunity to go start looking into them. Speaking of encrypted threats, that's another good ham-fisted segue into our next section.
Segue.
Just last week, VMware disclosed an unauthenticated code execution vulnerability in vCenter servers that could enable anyone with HTTPS access to the server to gain system-level code execution on the underlying server. Let's pause there.
There's a lot of bad there, man. You said unauthenticated, so that's one of the things I always listen for, is authenticated or unauthenticated makes a big difference. Unauthenticated with just web access to a web server. Wow. And full system control. This sounds like it's a big one, Mark.
It's about as bad as it gets. It's a 9.8 out of 10 on the vulnerability rating scale in terms of exploitability and damages caused. It's bad. So the vulnerability stems from a plugin that's enabled by default called vRealize Operations vCenter.
I know vRealize Operation. You said every day. Yeah. If you can't tell, I'm being sarcastic. What is that? I'm a VMware user, but I tend to use the personal, you know, research edition. So Fusion on the Mac and Workstation on the PC. This sounds like ESXi stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I technically maintain our ESXi servers that we have running on a couple of NUCs, but not to the capacity that we would ever have to look into what the heck vRealize Operations is. They bill it as basically their automation platform. There was a lot of like AI machine learning buzzwords thrown in the landing page when I was trying to figure out what it was. But basically it sounds like their cloud automation platform for spinning up and managing virtual machines on an ESXi server. And among other functions, as you might imagine, this plugin has the ability to upload OVA files to the vSphere server. So OVA being the archived image for a virtual machine on the server. And it turns out that archive for the OVA file is just a plain old boring tarball. And as part of the upload, the plugin will extract that OVA tar archive to the temp directory. But here's where it makes its first mistake. It chooses the save location by taking the temp directory and then just appending the file name to that path name without any filtering, which means that if I were to set the file name with ./ file name, instead of saving it in the intended directory, it would go one directory up. So I could get a little creative with some ./s and basically control wherever my file gets unarchived on that server.
By the way, that sounds very similar to all the, like, if there's been lots of past web exploits in Apache and other web servers that had to do early on with directory traversal or escaping like the root directory that the web's like, for Apache, I think it might be www root is a directory made in usually your Etsy folder, if I remember right, on Linux machines. And directory traversal sometimes could get you outside that kind of limited folder. This sounds pretty similar.
Yeah. I mean, the good news is with web servers like Apache and Nginx, like they know the severity of a type of issue like this. It's a web server that you are intentionally exposing to the internet. So they take a little more precautions in that like their web server daemon has limited permissions. If you were to get
So that's ultimately, just to be clear for the people that don't quite get it, there's a special user made for the web server that has enough permissions, of course, to show pages on the web server and do certain things, but it's not like the root system account. And so even if you took over the web server, you had a vulnerability that took over the web server and then you directory traversed somewhere, anything you could execute or put in that other directory would still require... It would only happen if that particular directory was allowable by the web server user, because you wouldn't get system. And the difference you're saying on this one is vRealize runs with system.
Yeah. So the hypervisor runs with system level permissions, as you might expect from a hypervisor
Hypervisor.
Yeah. But like even this plugin can basically abuse those permissions in that case. So unlike a web server where you would be isolated to the web directories, which in general is, you know, bad enough on its own, you wouldn't be able to, say, on an Apache server, save a web shell into the server root without someone having made a very bad mistake when setting up that server. In this case, though...
Or worse yet, if you were able to traverse even outside the web directories, which has happened before. Once you get in something like a user directory, the web user wouldn't have permissions to do anything in that normal computer directory either.
Yeah.
But in the case
of this VMware vulnerability, so you can basically trick the server into saving a file wherever you want. And additionally, that plugin has all of the permissions of system level on the server. And like I said, it's not gated by any authentication whatsoever. So on a Windows server, for an example, the researcher found that you could create a .jsp web shell. So JSP being similar to PHP or ASP as server-side scripting. And you can upload it to any web-accessible directory on the server and then trigger that web shell just by browsing to it in a web browser. And now you've got a root system-level web shell accessible over the internet. On Linux, you could use the same exploit and upload a new SSH key to the user's authorized keys file, And then if SSH is exposed, just connect over that straight to it with potentially root level access. Like this is,
it's just like adding an SSH user. The key there being that the victim has to have the SSH server already up and running and allowed through the firewall. But if you're a Linux server running web services for whatever reason, SSH is often a backup for coming to configure. So it's not uncommon, I guess.
Yeah. The good news is, like, as serious as these are, they are technically patched by VMware. Kind of the bad news, it took them 4 months to do it, which in the terms of a unauthenticated remote code execution vulnerability, that's pretty bad, in my opinion.
I agree. It's beyond the 90 days. And this seems like an easy. I think the additional bad news is how easy this is to exploit, Mark, right?
I could do it.
You know, exactly. If I can do it, it must be simple. I mean, there's a number of flaws that might be remote exploits, but they might take multi-packet or rely on chance depending on memory layout. This is literally just moving around in directories and dropping a web shell, which is kind of really 101 type hacking. So it's not something that needs a lot of specialized exploit code and understanding of debugging in order to figure out how to exploit it. You could probably, if you understand HTML and how to lay out tarballs, it, you know, archive file, it's pretty easy.
Yeah. And if you look on like Shodan or Binary Edge, like the number of exposed servers is somewhere between 7,000 and 15,000.
That just seems kind of nuts, because for that to happen, you have to be exposing your web management interface of VMware, ESXi servers. So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, obviously, a virtual server is something that, especially if it's in the cloud or in some other data center, you do want remote access to as the person maintaining a bunch of remote virtual machines. But why the heck would you expose that to the world?
Yeah, and I get it, like this plugin is to interface with these cloud applications, but there's no way that VMware would require you to port forward traffic to your management interface for your server through the internet. Like, set up a VPN or some other way to securely connect to it.
Set up a VPN, or at least just an access control list for the people that need to connect, and to your point, Mark, any other automated services out there that need to use the automation plugin. But either way, it should be a controlled access list or purely just an encrypted authentication connection using some tunneling to a private
network. So if you are...
whatever type of VPN
If you are using vCenter Server 6.5, 6.7, or 7.0, make sure you install the latest update as soon as possible. And if you had it exposed to the internet, I would honestly say take a look at that server, because there's a high likelihood it's been compromised, because like Corey said, this is a pretty dang easy one. Like, it's on par with the Citrix flaws we saw a couple years ago that led to a rash of breaches across a bunch of different companies. Like, it's as bad as it gets, and it's pretty dang easy to exploit.
I'd even go to the point of you have a VMware server on a remote one that you're managing over the web, it's probably doing something big for production for you, especially if you automated it. So not only is it big and easy to exploit with a lot of exposure, it's probably a valuable server to you.
So make sure you install those patches. If for some reason you can't, VMware also put out a knowledge base with a workaround, basically instructions for connecting over SSH to your server and disabling the plugin itself. But I mean, patch, and then do a little bit of analysis to make sure you didn't already get hit by this one, because it's a bit scary. And there's 15,000 servers floating around there that potentially could have been hit.
And to the disclosure date of this, I think, if I remember right, was probably around February 23rd, February 24th. So by the time you hear this, you've had about a week that the world has known about it. So if you haven't patched in that time, that's why Mark wants you to check.
Yep. So let's move on to our last bit. As part of the fallout for the SolarWinds breach that I'm sure we're all probably sick of hearing about now, the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee asked several executives, including the CEOs of FireEye, SolarWinds, CrowdStrike, as well as Microsoft president and top lawyer Brad Smith, to testify on their company's roles in the event. And as part of his opening statement, Brad Smith, he advocated for really increased regulations, or at least stronger obligations on private sector organizations to disclose security events. So his quote that stood out to me was, State and local governments, hospitals, and countless other entities are constantly under attack, and yet silence reigns. This is a recipe for making a formidable problem worse, and it requires all of us to change. We need to replace this silence with a clear, consistent obligation for private sector organizations to disclose when they're impacted by confirmed and significant incidents. The other executives, they didn't go so far as to call for increased regulation, but they did agree that there needs to be more information sharing across businesses and government. Smith compared the patchwork set of obligations the U.S. to the EU's much more stringent reporting requirements, and thought this would be a good opportunity to like test the waters and see what are your thoughts, Corey? Like, is this something where we need the government to step in, or is this something that the private industry can solve on their own? Because there is an issue with threat actors targeting private companies, and because we're not sharing information willingly, like others can't learn from it to stop similar incidents from occurring.
Yeah, and I think if folks have listened to us on the podcast, they probably know you and I are for transparency for the most part. And it's all about sharing those extra little details are a good way for other folks to learn, you know. You can say you were breached and only this data got affected and inform all the customers what to do, but knowing the techniques and the tactics and maybe even the individual issues on your infrastructure that the bad guys exploited to get in, that gives people information about what they should be protecting themselves. So at a very high level, the idea is okay. But I do kind of have questions and issues with it. I mean, the first question I would come up is, we have this to some extent when people besides the private company itself are impacted. We have federal mandatory data breach disclosure laws. If there is a breach that affects your customer, or I believe even your employee PII too, you have to notify those people to make them safe. So there's two parts of if you suffer a breach, why should it matter to the world beyond just the gossipy news people want to gossip about it? One is if you're kind of a person that holds data of value that belongs to someone else, and this is the customer employee information I'm talking about. So we definitely have that covered. I guess the second reason is what you and I were talking about, Mark. It's just so others can learn from you. And that's the only part that's not mandated. Like if there's a breach that only affects the company, it hurts them in some way, but let's theoretically imagine it didn't touch any customer or employee data, even though that's kind of sometimes hard to prove. You know, you could also argue, why should they tell anybody? It's hurt them. They moved on. Maybe it's even a undue burden and cost for them to, you know, tell all kinds of people and do notification. So you are putting some burden on companies to do this if you regulate it. But
which is something that Smith actually like he talked about in his opening statement, where we need some form of like incentive, like maybe limited liability protections for organizations that come out and freely share information about the incident with others. Because
yeah. And that, like, I think you're about that would to get be important into, to business. Yeah.
No one wants to get caught with their pants down where they've made some form of mistake that could potentially land them in legal trouble. And like we cut deals with criminals all the time where, you know, if they cooperate, they get a more lenient sentence. And in the case of businesses, potentially if they are forthright in some of their blunders so we could get some information on the threat actors, maybe they get a more lenient response as well.
Even a criminal that's broken the law gets a lenient response if he tells on his friends.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm simplifying it, maybe putting in a negative context, but it's that sort of thing. The thing is, the business still realizes that if they show negligence in some way, they still could have that punishment. So I think from the business perspective, they'll be a little worried about this. The other thing I don't like about it is while it's encouraging the transparency for learning, it also is only defining some cases. And it's not defining that some good enough. And whenever there's law that has generic speak, I feel like, you know, people can push it. Is every little phishing incident when someone clicks on someone but doesn't enter a credential, do I need to report that? I'm being facetious. Hopefully that's not covered, but do I have to report that? Because at the end of your quote, he says, when they're impacted. Okay, define impact. We already mandatory disclose breaches when we are impacted, because the impact is customer data. So what is changing to the impact? What do you mean by when you're impacted? Sure, I could use my own brain. Well, ransomware probably counts, but I don't like that general term, even though I can use my own brain to guess what he means. If you have that in law, you know, it becomes too general. What is a significant incident? A confirmed significant incident? Define significant for me. You know what I mean? So I just, in the state of that statement there, I don't think this should be law. I think you need to have real big definitions. If you want people to report breaches where they haven't lost other people's stuff, it's just affected them, you need to pretty clearly outline all the attributes of that breach, of the impact that has to have, and of the detail you have to share. Because otherwise it just becomes, I think it becomes untenable, because people can use it in lots of ways and they can use it against you. What if I have a tiny little phishing incident that I don't think turned into an impactful breach? It does somehow come out because maybe an employee leaks a note and this regulation is on the book and someone sues me for not reporting a fish. You know, to me, that would be absolutely ludicrous and stupid. And yet it could happen if you have language that is not exact enough.
Which we know historically the U.S. federal government isn't the best when it comes to technical laws. But like Brad Smith wasn't being naive about this. He even pointed out like there are difficult tactical and organizational questions that need to be addressed in determining the structure of these obligations. And he even pointed out like we need to figure out what is the threshold for defining incidents and whether they're significant or not to be reported. Like what is the timeline? How do we control how the information proliferates? Who has access to it? How do we protect that? Because again, like we can report all of our threat intel on what we found out about a breach, but you have to protect that too, because if the attackers figure out what you know, like they're just going to change how they or how they run their
attacks. And hopefully by the time you're sharing this, you've changed your infrastructure. But if this is learning, you might be having to describe something in your infrastructure that now all the world knows that you have. So, you know what I mean? Anyways, at the very high level, I think you and I agree. We would love to see companies openly share more technical detail about the attacks they suffer, only for the learning part of it. You know, if you could somehow make it a way that this was only positive for that learning, I think it at a high level, that makes sense. I just am skeptical now that one, private businesses will support this law. Because I think to them it might mean burden, and two, that it's going to be hard to write it in a way that works well and doesn't allow for some weirdness.
Yep. And that was basically like his points were, it culminated to like a plea for help. Like this is something that they cannot solve on their own and they need help getting the ball rolling. And I think that's basically where we're at, where something needs to be addressed. Like we need some easy way to incentivize and share information, and we just need like assistance all coming together and coming up with that idea in a way that isn't overly burdensome for organizations big or small. So it'll be interesting to see what comes of it. Like I feel like the SolarWinds breach really brought security to the forefront for a lot of organizations, and it could lead to some change federally or even globally. I guess time will tell on whether Microsoft's pleas for more regulations on them actually come to fruition.
I wonder what SolarWinds thinks about this, because this is putting up rumor and gossip hat. But at one point, the SolarWinds new CEO, the CEO during the breach is different than the one now, but the new CEO had commented that Microsoft was more involved in their breach than Microsoft is saying. So it's kind of funny that it, you know, that's a claim, that's an allegation. You can find an article from the CEO. Maybe that's why Microsoft is pushing for this, because they are actually being open and they think the opposite. But whatever the reason, I'm curious what SolarWinds thought of Brad. They were there. SolarWinds was part of this crew, right?
I feel like we say this every week, but I feel like the story of the SolarWinds breach is still not done being written.
I think it'll keep leaking out for a while now, and then every other company that was slightly affected.
Well, hopefully we can all learn something from it, and whether that takes government interaction or just private businesses finding their own incentives to share information. Like, there's a lot we can do. So,
and there's a lot of information out there, by the way. There's companies that are being as transparent as they can with breaches already. So that's always good. I think we commented on FireEye. They were affected by the SolarWinds breach themselves and shared a lot of good detail about it. So that's good.
Yeah. Or we can just all migrate towards a future where hacks don't happen and we all play nicely with each other and Corey and I are out of jobs.
I'm sure that utopia exists. I say with a cringing straight face.
That is like seething sarcasm coming from you through that microphone.
Yeah. I'm a pretty good guy and I'm not perfect all the time. I don't know how society is ever going to be.
Yar. Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_, Corey's at @SecAdept, and the both of us are at #The443Podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week.
Smash subscribe and that bell. Wait a second. Do podcasts have a bell? I don't know. Smash that subscribe.
Maybe we should PewDiePie and just hack people's printers to subscribe to the 443.
Subscribe to 443. We got to one-up it. We should hack VR headsets and like have it 3D just text in all their headsets.
Sure hope that's not illegal.
Let's try and find out.
Okay.
It'll make a good episode when the FBI come interview us on our show.
Oh, boy.